Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is the Healthy Mind Radio Show. Here, we talk about our emotional health and well-being, about living the most authentic life we possibly can, the one we truly deserve. So take notice, our true strength and action are on the march, while our fears and self-doubt are on the run. Never doubt how truly powerful you are. Let's learn together, right here on The Healthy Mind. Oh yes, well, welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. I'm your host, Dr. Peter Zafiridis, and this is The Healthy Mind Podcast for July 11th, 2012. I hope you're doing well. Hope you're having a great week so far. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. Well, I hope you've had a great week. A happy 4th of July to you. We had some amazing weather that came through here, but it is sunny skies, and I have a fantastic program for you today. We're going to be talking about emotions. How about that, right? Big surprise on the healthy mind. But emotions and logic. And what a curious and complex relationship between the two. We're going to be talking about that. Why do emotions sometimes get ahead of us, even though we know better? And would you believe some very important reasons why sometimes our emotions should get ahead of us? But we'll talk about that relationships, how sometimes it gets us into trouble or it short circuits with regards to anxiety, mood, and heck, even chronic pain. I've got some great news for you today. You're going to want to stick around for it. Some really important news that came out with regards to meditation. If you're thinking about starting it, if you're overwhelmed or not sure what type of meditation style to use, you're going to want to stick around for the second half of the program. So we've got a busy show today. We'll do some headlines, and heck, we've got ourselves a heck of a podcast. All right. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. You can email me at any time. Really appreciate the email. Some great health and wellness questions. I really think I'm going to start reading some of the listener email in future podcasts, but some great emails. Peter@thehealthymind.com. Okay, now, the emotions, right? The emotions and logic. How many times has this gotten us into trouble, right? You put your foot in your mouth. You get ahead of yourself. Maybe you get too angry or you overreact with anxiety, whatever the case. But sometimes our emotions can get the best of us. We look back in retrospect and, gosh, what was I thinking? Is what we say to ourselves as to why we react in the way that we do. Why? Why does this happen? Why do the emotions get the best of us sometimes? And this is where I want to go. And to start it off, I just want to give an example. Okay, I'm going to illustrate the point. And you are going to be involved in this, okay? All right. Here's the scene. You and I are in the kitchen, right? We're cleaning up dinner, and all of a sudden, I don't know, a cork from a bottle of wine falls into the drain where the garbage disposal is. Now, the garbage disposal isn't on, but I say, go ahead and fish that out with your hand. Do you stick your hand in the garbage disposal and grab the cork? Do you? What is it that you do? For many, many people, when I use this example in my sessions, they say, no way, I'm not putting my hand in there. Okay, the garbage disposal isn't on. Doesn't matter, I don't care. I'm not putting my hand down in there. There could be a short in the garbage disposal, and my hand could get mangled. Okay, next. I go down to the fuse box and flick off the breaker so there's absolutely no juice going to the garbage disposal. There's no way. There's nothing going to the entire kitchen. Now, when I say, go ahead and put your hand in there and grab that cork for me, will you? What do you do? Did you do it? Did you do it? It's tough, isn't it? Surprisingly, a lot of people still say, no, I'm not putting my hand in the garbage disposal. Just no way. But why? Why does that happen? Let me give you another example. All right, we'll do some examples here today. You are taking a bath. Nice, relaxing bath at the end of the day. Hey, I deserve it. I'm taking a bath and it's very calm and quiet. And all of a sudden, I walk in holding a hairdryer in my hand. It's not plugged in, but there's a hairdryer there. And I say, you know, I'm going to throw this in there. Is that all right? What do? You say yes, go ahead. No, of course not. But wait a minute, why? Why did you say of course not? Because most people will say, well, no, no way. The hairdryer isn't plugged in. And even though people know that, they'll say, well, nah, I just don't want to take a chance, okay? So this is the point I hope you're starting to see, right? Whether it's the garbage disposal or the hairdryer in the bathtub that's not plugged in. Instinctively, we say no out of fear. Our logic gets trumped by the emotion of the moment. And even though it's logical, in both cases, there's no electricity going anywhere near you, most people will say, no way, I won't take that chance, whether it's a garbage disposal or the hairdryer in the bathtub. Okay, Zafiridis, so what does this have to do with everything we're talking about here? And how could this possibly relate to emotional disorders or physical disorders like physical pain? Well, there's a lot of research that's been done, particularly in the field of evolutionary psychology. Scientists who look at the behavior that we have right now, our behavior patterns, and they try to explain the evolution of that behavior, maybe where some of that came from, maybe where anxiety disorders or anxiety comes from. What's the purpose, if any, of depression? Was there a purpose for it earlier on in our evolution? And it's a very interesting thing that we begin to see. The evolutionary psychologists say, wait a minute, there may be a very important survival-based mechanism for our emotions getting ahead of us. They say that, look, the reason that we react in that way, say like the examples I gave you, or when a person feels hesitant to do something for fear of a panic attack, or a person who's been in chronic pain when they get better, or in the work that I do in the mind-body type of pains, are terrified or are worried to re-engage back in activity for fear of the pain. The reason that that anxiety is there pays tribute to our evolutionary history. And why is this the case? Well, a few million years ago, we didn't worry about a hairdryer or a garbage disposal or having a panic attack in a Walmart. Not at all. Back then, reaction could mean the difference between living and dying, seeing something shaking in the bushes, and acting almost instinctually on emotion to get out of the way so that a saber-toothed tiger or some threat didn't attack you. Okay? So in that, we don't wait. Gosh, how do I remember what that shaking was like in the bush? I bolt. I get out of there. There's no real harm to overreacting. If I overreact and there's nothing in the bush, I'm still alive. But if I underreact, I'm dead. Okay, that's what was happening for years and years and years. And really, if we look at our evolution, really in the last 10,000 years or so, roughly for the agricultural revolution, the stressors that we have today and really over the last 300 or 400 years, the stressors that we have today just from evolution has not been enough time for our minds to evolve to reacting properly, let's say, to the complexity of today's modern stressors. We still have the potential and the tendency to react in an all-or-none fashion. So, the emotions will get ahead of us for a very important reason. Survival. It doesn't matter that it isn't life or death for a certain situation when we have a panic attack, but it feels that way. Anyone who's had real bad anxiety knows, even though it's out of proportion, even though it doesn't make sense, for example, that I should have a panic attack when I walk into a Walmart, I still feel like I'm going to die, so I don't go. Another example, even though I know there's nothing wrong structurally with my back or my knee or my neck, I'm terrified about going out there and taking a chance on my back by exercising or lifting things. Okay? I hope you're starting to appreciate that, because a lot of times people get so down on themselves and condemn themselves for feeling the way that they are without giving themselves a chance to at least respect the complexity of what goes into our emotional reactions, particularly when we feel we overreact. Now, I'm not trying to imply that all of this is automatic, that we have no free will. We do. We have the ability to change some of these automatic reactions or these automatic thoughts that we have that may limit us. All I'm trying to do is to help you understand the reason why our emotions may get ahead of our logic at times. It's a glimpse, really, into our evolutionary past. All of us will do it, and certainly having an anxiety disorder or having a pain disorder, whatever it may cause someone to react much more intensely, of course. But the fact that our emotions get ahead of our logic is not an accident. There's a lot of purpose there. Okay, so what does this all mean? All right, you did a great job, blabbered away for so long explaining that to me. I think I got it, Zafiridis, but what does this really mean? I mean, how do I apply this? And this is what I tell people. Look, there may be times when you overreact. Perhaps your anger gets the best of you. You have an argument with a loved one or a coworker or a friend. Your anxiety gets the best of you, and it's hard for you to give a presentation, or you're totally stressed out and can't focus on studying for a test. Or, especially what I do with treatment of some of these mind-body disorders, people feel so limited by the possibility that they could exacerbate their pain, even though they can believe logically, when they're not as stressed, that there may be absolutely nothing wrong with their body or their back or their neck, wherever the pain is. It's important to realize that our emotions will get ahead of us. And in that very moment, we may not be able to control how we are feeling, but we owe it to ourselves. Really, it's an obligation to ourselves and those around us to really take the time afterwards, when the dust is settled, if you will, the emotional dust is settled, and really analyze where that came from. Give yourself that compassion. We're wired to react emotionally well before logic kicks in, okay? So take that time. Realize what's going on there. Compassion. If it's anger and you're in the wrong, go in there and apologize to the person. If it's anxiety, cut yourself a break. Understand where you're coming from and try it again. If it's physical pain, those psychophysiologic disorders, take the time to realize that there's nothing wrong with your body. And then try to re-engage again. This is how we move on. Once we understand how our mind works, we can really begin to make profound change in our lives, emotionally and physically. You'll see it happen. And when you do, my goodness, now that is a wonderful first step to take down our road to the healthy mind. And now it's time for news. Okay. Wow, some great health news today, particularly the psychological health news today. A couple of stories that I really want to cover. This first one was really, really hopeful. We're talking about anxiety, and it's studies like this that really should give people hope about the future treatments for anxiety disorders and mood in general. But the headline, Dynorphin, Why Anxiety Won't Go Away. Now, this was an international team of scientists, and what they may just have discovered was why, at least for some individuals, anxiety persists abnormally after a stressful event. Now, when we have a particular stressful event, let's say a trauma, maybe the death of a loved one, the loss of a marriage, whatever it may be, what happens? Now, as we've just talked, our feelings of anxiety really can help us to prevent us from getting into situations that are too dangerous. But if we've had a terrible experience, a trauma of some sort, we tend to avoid the particular place where that happened out of fear. It's protective. But following certain emotional stressors, we know that for some people, chronic anxiety can develop. PTSD, post-traumatic stress, it happens. And even after months, the anxiety does not subside. So why? Why does this happen? Why is it that in some people, these terrible events are deeply engraved in their memory, while others may have the exact same trauma, but yet it passes and they're not bogged down by it? And as I said, this was an international study done at the University of Bonn, B-O-N-N. And the scientists there took a look at a substance known as dynorphin that occurs in our body. D-Y-N-O-R-P-H-I-N, like endorphins. But dynorphin. And what they found was that these substances put a damper on our emotional moods, like anxiety. So that there was a relationship between the amount of dynorphin and an individual's ability to prevent a difficult stress from becoming a chronic anxiety issue. One of the research scientists, Dr. Andreas Zimmer from the University of Bonn, said, quote, "We were able to demonstrate by way of a series of experiments that dynorphin plays an important role in weakening anxiety." But what are dynorphins? And dynorphins are in the group of substances known as opioids that occur in the body, naturally occurring opioids like endorphins, those chemicals that get released when we're exerting ourselves or that athletes release that have an analgesic effect. They decrease pain and they give us a euphoric effect. Well, the reverse is true with the dynorphins. They blunt the mood. They turn down the volume to our emotional mood. Now, these individual scientists tested this effect of dynorphins on the brain using mice. And what they did was they changed the gene so that dynorphin, that substance, would not get expressed. And what they found was that mice that had a normal release of dynorphins, when they were provoked to be anxious, got anxious, but then the symptoms went away after a period of time. But in the mice that were genetically engineered to not release those dynorphins, the anxiety continued. The interesting part here is that the researchers showed that these particular results that they found in the mice can be transferred to people. Another researcher, Dr. Henrik Walter, said, quote, "We took advantage of the fact that people exhibit natural variations of the dynorphin gene that lead to different levels of the substance being released in the brain." And they did these studies in the variances of dynorphin in these individuals, and they put them through a series of experiments that would make them anxious or nervous. And then they measured their levels of dynorphin. And what they found, both in mice and men, was that those with a lower gene activity for dynorphin exhibited stress reactions lasting considerably longer than those who released considerably more dynorphin. And an additional, rather fascinating point was that the scientists also had noticed some changes in certain parts of the brain that also affected whether or not people were able to move past a trauma and not be chronically affected by it or not. There were two parts of the brain, one part known as the amygdala, which is a part of the brain that processes the content of our emotions, and an area of the brain which is important. It activates when we are forgetting, let's say, a memory, allowing it to fade. It takes activity. And this area of the brain is known as the ventromedial prefrontal cortex. And what they found was the folks that didn't have as much dynorphin activity was that there wasn't enough crosstalk between those two parts of the brain. And because of that, memories couldn't be forgotten and the emotional stress and activity would not fade. Going back to Dr. Walter, he said, quote, "In all likelihood, dynorphins affect fear forgetting in a crucial way through these structures," end of quotes. What they're hoping for is to continue this research, but as they state, some of these findings are brand new and they can be groundbreaking, and they hope that by using these results someday, we will have meaningfully different long-term approaches when it comes to treating those who have been through traumas and those with anxiety disorders. The details of that particular study I have up on the website. If you're struggling with anxiety or have a loved one who's struggling with that or trauma, take a look. This is really groundbreaking information and really stands to offer some hope to people in the future as we treat these anxiety disorders and trauma. Okay, we're going to change gears a little bit with this next news piece. We've been talking a lot about anxiety and how we may overreact and the like. But one of the healthiest things that we can do, both for our emotional and physical well-being, is to meditate. I hope that you've taken the time to at least explore meditation and maybe consider it, if you're not doing it already, as part of your daily routine. Now, there's a ton of different meditation styles. All you have to do is a basic search for meditation, and sometimes it can be overwhelming. There's so many styles to pick from. Well, how do you know which one is right for you? And the headline, choosing a meditation style that's right for you. And it turns out this has been researched and studied. And according to a new study published in the journal Explore, those of us who are new to meditation should really choose a method with which we feel most comfortable with, not necessarily the most popular one. According to the researchers, if you choose the most comfortable method, what will happen? Well, if you're comfortable with it, you're going to stick with it. If you go with just the one that's popular but might not speak to you, there's a greater chance you'll abandon the meditation and you lose out on all of those healthful benefits, both emotionally and physically. Now, Dr. Adam Burke from San Francisco State University is one of the researchers who did the studies, and he said, quote, "Because of the increase in both general and clinical use of meditation, you want to make sure you're finding the right method for each person." Now, in the study, they took individuals and they had them explore four different types of meditation: mindfulness meditation, mantra, Zen, and Qigong visualization. And what they wanted to see was, in these people new to meditation, which one did they prefer? Which one did they like if they had the option of all of them? And what they found was, not real surprisingly, mindfulness and mantra meditations were preferred by about a third of those who did the study. And what this showed was that a simpler, maybe more accessible type of method of meditation is what people prefer. Now, keep in mind, no one technique is the best for everyone. But if you're looking at maybe doing meditation, take the time to explore them. There's so much available out there on the internet: guided meditations, guided mindfulness meditations, or mantras, that you can try out a bunch and see what fits the most for you. You don't have to get overwhelmed, not at all. Try it. If you don't like it, doesn't speak to you, move to the next one. But don't give up, because just a small amount of meditation that you do regularly can have a profound effect on your health, both physically and emotionally. So, the right type of meditation style for you, for all of us? No surprise. It's the one that we feel most comfortable with. That's the one that we'll stick with. Now, with the time that we have left, I just want to blast through the remainder of the news headlines in a segment that I like to call the Healthy Mind Headlines. Okay, the first headline. Cutting daily sitting time to under 3 hours might extend life by 2 years. Restricting the amount of time spent seated every day to less than 3 hours might boost the life expectancy of U.S. adults by an extra 2 years, according to a study published in the online journal BMJ Open. The next headline. Hormone curbs depressive-like symptoms in stressed mice. A hormone with anti-diabetic properties also reduces depression-like symptoms in mice. This was from a study from the School of Medicine at the University of Texas Health Center in San Antonio. And finally, Facebook use leads to depression? No, says a Wisconsin study. A study of university students is the first evidence to refute the supposed link between depression and the amount of time spent on Facebook and other social media sites. Facebook and depression. Ugh, the maladies of the modern world. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we have done it again, you and I. We have made it to the end of yet another broadcast of The Healthy Mind. Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to listen to the program. I really do appreciate it. The website, as always, www.thehealthymind.com. Don't forget, I'm on Twitter. You can follow me there at Dr. Zafiridis. And any questions you may have, comments, criticisms, anything, I want to hear from you. Take the time. The email address is peter@thehealthymind.com. That's peter@thehealthymind.com. And for the Healthy Mind podcast, part of the Healthy Mind Network, I'm Dr. Peter Zafiridis. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time right here on The Healthy Mind.